Good morning, everybody. Welcome to Dark Crest Epistemology, March 18th, 2024, from Lexington, Kentucky. An incredibly beautiful day today. Quite cold. Got down to like 27, 28 last night, and it's still cold this morning. So it was a beautiful weekend, and it got cold today. So it's going to be a little cold this week. But the grass is growing, the mowers are mowing, and my neighbors were out all weekend. I could hear the lawnmowers running. I did some troubleshooting with my neighbor's auto mower. Had to run a whole new line. So I probably will end up doing like a standalone video on auto mowers. I think it'd be beneficial for those people looking into it, because it is worth it, but it just comes with a whole another set of management practices. It's kind of like maybe a little bit like artificial turf. I mean, you still have to maintain it. Just a different type of maintenance. So I may end up doing that. We're going to talk about potassium today. We have a really good paper, and we're going to talk about some podcast stuff. Randy, good morning. Says, hello, Dr. Chaddix in chat, waiting for 1,000 subscribers. Yeah, I'm getting close. I mean, it'll probably hit 1,000 today or tomorrow. That'll be interesting. So I guess that's a good little milestone. What am I at right now? It's at 990. So yeah, probably today or tomorrow, it'll cross 1,000. Really appreciate everybody showing up and contributing to that. Internet Surfer, good morning. Andrew Burris, good morning. Brady419, good morning. Transition Zone Guy 7B, good morning to everybody. Yeah, 20, Brady, you're a little north of me, 20s, yeah. So it got cold, dropped probably, I don't know, 40 or 50 degrees. I mean, it was high 60s or 70s yesterday in the afternoon, and it dropped down to high 20s this morning. So it got cold. as you know, my daughter's a little bit under the weather the last couple of days, and I think I caught something. I don't know yet, but my voice is, I can feel it in my throat. It's a little bit, it might not last. We'll see how it goes. So you may hear me, you know, having a lozenge in my mouth. I apologize. It's either that or I have to shut it off because I can't hardly talk. So I'm going to talk slow and low, and hopefully I can get through it. Before I go move forward, tomorrow morning's show will be at 9 a.m. rather than 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. I'm moving it up 1 hour just for that, just for tomorrow, for a good reason. We have a guest on tomorrow that I suspect that many people will want to listen to. So whenever I have a guest, I accommodate their schedule, and tomorrow's schedule will start at 9 a.m. to accommodate the guest's schedule. So you will probably want to be here tomorrow for that. We're going to be talking about potassium tomorrow as well. So whenever I can, I like to have the authors on so I don't mess up a paper. But that reminds me, I was going back, I started... as you know, I'm going to change the schedule starting in April to where I'm only in the morning on Monday morning and then on Thursday evening to allow me time to go back and edit some of the papers. And I started doing that already. And when I went through it, I started back from the beginning. Some of those early ones are not good. And one of them, I just messed up. I didn't even realize it. I went back and started watching it again and started editing it. And I realized I completely screwed up the whole thing. So I'm going to remove that one from the YouTube. It'll still be on the podcast, but I'm going to remove that from YouTube. And then I'm just going to redo that paper. It's a potassium paper on cold acclimation, I think it is, or freeze tolerance. I can't remember what it was now, but I completely screwed it up. So, yeah, so I'm going to fix that. That reminds me, and as I was listening to it and editing this, I realized a couple times I'll say things. I don't realize that I'm saying it when I'm saying it live. I'm saying it wrong. I don't realize it. So please, if I say anything that sounds peculiar or doesn't quite line up for some reason, just reach out to me and ask, did you mean this? Or did, you know, I heard this, but it, you know, it's because sometimes I misspeak and I don't realize it when I'm live. So please be aware of that. It's not intentional. It's just, you know, one of my little challenges I work with. So let's go to the First of all, let's go to the YouTube. So the memberships are open. Many of you are here today are already members. Thank you very much. And I just want to make sure everybody's aware that King Kong, good morning. That the memberships for the channel do two things. One, it helps me pay for to keep the channel open, to keep all this, pay all this equipment and pay, you know, for all the internet stuff and to keep things running, the podcast and so forth. But any additional revenue, if you missed last Thursday, I want to make sure everybody understands that if you're not like, if you're not so warm and fuzzy, like, I don't want to join a YouTube channel, but I wouldn't mind contributing to Turfgrass Research. The remaining revenue after I pay for all the expenses of this will go to support Turfgrass Research that I conduct. And what I've decided I'll do for the members is I will, very likely, I will put on the chat or on the community tabs the project that I'm conducting and kind of just behind the scenes sort of things, kind of daily things that I'm doing and some expenses and just sort of how research operates. So you kind of have, you follow along and you know, hopefully you would know that, you know, where your resources are going, you know, where your membership funds are going, what are they going to support? And, so that's kind of what I'm thinking is that I'll use the community tab for the memberships to communicate what I'm doing in research. Cause I mean, I'm going to be doing this research for years and you won't see a publication for years and it can kind of get lost. Like, oh, is he still doing that? Yeah, I'm still doing it. Okay. Still doing the sulfur work. Still trying to get that published. It just takes time to get that stuff out. And, so that's my intention is to use any additional revenue from the channel to support the work that I do and to get it published. And there's just fees and, you know, I'll be happy to share all the exact invoices and prices and revenue from the channel. So everybody's on the up and up who contributes and where all the money is and how much things cost and so forth. So that's kind of what I'm thinking is that's the way I'll move forward with this. We're not dealing with tens of thousands of dollars usually, but we're dealing with thousands of dollars to get something published. And so any time you want to be a member, those funds will go to support that. And then probably what I'll occasionally do is maybe just do like a small fundraiser to get something published as when that comes around. Like, hey, this is finished. I need to get it published. It costs $1,500 and I'll have an episode or something. I think you can do, I'm not really sure what you can do, but I think you can do like super chats or something. I don't even know what that is, but I'm not real sure, but I think there's a button on the chat function where you can donate just like $5 extra or $10 extra, whatever. And I'll probably do like an episode simply to promote, hey, this funding is to support this research and so forth. So that's a little bit what my thoughts are on that, but I'll keep you informed as I move forward. Okay. So let's go. What I would like to do a little bit is to show some love to some of the podcast listeners today. I, for those of you who may not be aware, if you just watch YouTube, I use the audio from the shows and I load them to the podcast platforms as soon as they're available, which is usually the following day. So the episode number we're doing right now, it takes about 12 to 13 hours for YouTube to process it. And then I can take the audio and load it to the podcast platforms the following morning. And many people are listening to it on podcasts. I'm actually surprised so many people listen to it on podcasts. I'm getting roughly around 1,000 downloads a week on the podcast platforms, which shocks me. I didn't realize so many people listen to it on podcasts. So I wanted to kind of give a little bit of a little bit of information about the podcast because I like the way the service that I use is called Podbean. I like the way they provide data, and I thought it might be interesting some of you all who listen to get a little love from where you're at in the world. Good morning, Ignacio. Thank you for being here today. Oh, Gray Fox says you can do a super chat. Oh, but YouTube takes 40%. Okay, I didn't know that, Gray. Yeah, that's a big chunk. I didn't know that. So maybe there's a more efficient way to do this. Well, it's just, it's all in process. It's all in development. We'll figure it out. But it's, you know, sort of like a standalone funding event is, you know, a ways away. You know, it's not anytime soon, but I'm trying to figure out a way to do that if you all want to contribute to that. So let's see if I can get this on screen. So this is what I'm looking at for those listening on podcast. This is for you all. I'm looking at the map on my podcast delivery platform, the map of the world. And it shows, I guess, every country in the world. And I'm just shocked at how many different countries there are people downloading. Now, I'm assuming that it's actually a person downloading and not a bot or somebody on a VPN or something. All that could definitely be true. But assuming someone's actually there and downloading, we have people listening and downloading to the channel from Canada, from the United States, from someone, several people are in Australia, apparently. A lot of people, a lot of downloads from Australia, Russia, which... I hope you're doing well in Russia. They just had a their dictator elected again through a sham election. Not to get too far off on the political road, but they're dealing with some challenges over there, the Russian people. And I'm not really sure what the answer is, but regardless, we have someone there listening to Turfgrass Epistemology in Russia. Iceland, France, Ireland, Ghana, Norway, Italy, Philippines, Denmark, Poland, United Kingdom, Jamaica. I'll be down. Is it Jamaica I'm going to in a couple of weeks? I can't remember. If I don't know if it's Jamaica or somewhere down there I'm going to in a couple of weeks. Portugal, Romania, Aruba, Switzerland, Egypt, Netherlands, New Zealand, and Slovakia. Just a really eclectic group of countries that are listening to this. I'm really impressed. I didn't realize so many people all around, you know, the world listen. And if you look in the United States, I almost have every state, almost. There's like maybe 8 or 9 states that we don't have someone downloaded yet from, but any of the podcast download from, but it's like Maine and North Dakota and Wyoming and Idaho and New Mexico and Alaska. These states don't have Rhode Island and maybe Connecticut. No, Connecticut has somebody in Connecticut. There's just a few states left that haven't downloaded the podcast, but I mean, you know, most of them are in Florida, California, Virginia, Texas, Pennsylvania, Michigan, Georgia, Illinois. I mean, North Carolina. I mean, there's hundreds of downloads happening in these states. To be frank, I'm just shocked. Thank you for listening. I'm glad people are enjoying it and downloading the podcast. I have found myself, because I'll listen to it just to see the audio quality, see if something sounds funny or make sure that it sounds correct. You know, everything's functioning correctly. And if I need to make any changes, sometimes I'll listen to it. And I kind of do prefer listening to it on the podcast when I'm in the car. So when I'm just driving, I can, my phone's not on and you can listen to it through the car. So I kind of do like that. So I appreciate everybody who listens and on the podcast. So anyway, just wanted to show that the podcast is active and there's a lot of people listening to it. So thank you for listening and I hope you're enjoying it. And I hope it's being, you find it useful to you in your turfgrass endeavors. Okay. So that's that about the channel and about podcasts. What I want to do now is I want to jump to the episode or to the article because I don't know how long my voice is going to last. We've been going over potassium for a couple weeks now. And the last episode we went over, or one of the last episodes we went over the Bayer paper with Doug Soldat's team up in Wisconsin. And they had some very interesting conclusions in that paper regarding soil tests and their ability to predict the need for potassium. And essentially, they concluded that the Malic 3 soil test for that soil that they used, which was a putting green sand soil, was not useful to predict potassium because there were so many other contributions to potassium in the soil that the test couldn't account for. And those were things like potassium bearing minerals such as feldspars and so forth. In a sandy soil, the release of potassium from the top dressing sands was enough to support the growth of the turf. They didn't need to apply any more potassium through fertilizers. And in fact, the application of potassium through fertilizers resulted in an increase in microdochium patch on those bent grass greens up there. And so the topic was introduced, or I introduced the topic through that paper. But that concept has been around for quite a while. The idea that you don't really need to apply potassium in many cases, even if the soil test says you do. Because in many soils, there's minerals in the soil that are releasing potassium that are not accounted for in the test, which is, again, a reason why I don't put a whole lot of confidence in the numbers on a soil. Well, the numbers on a soil test are valid in many regards, but the interpretation of the test is the challenge. And with potassium, there's two things that can happen. Well, many things that can happen, but at least two. And one of them is the absorption of clay. Some clay minerals can actually absorb clay out of soil solution. And the other is the release of potassium. And that's what we're going to be, that's what we talked about in the previous paper, the Bayer paper, and that's what we're going to talk about today in the Dest and Gallard paper, where some soils have a tremendous capacity to mineralize potassium from the existing soil, okay? And these are in sands. So I want to make sure I emphasize that. We're talking about sand soils in putting greens that have sufficient minerals to release potassium to basically eliminate the need to apply potassium. So imagine what would happen in a native soil that is that has a mixture of sand and silt and clay and so forth. It just reinforces over and over and over in the literature that the application of potassium on native soils with normal growing turf grass is probably unnecessary. The likelihood that you're going to see a benefit is extremely small for many reasons, but one key reason is that it's very likely that even when the soil test says that potassium is deficient, the turf grass may not in fact be deficient. Okay. It's very likely that's the case with potassium. Okay. So before we get started, Internet Surfer, you're making a difference. There is a lack of good evidence-based turf grass care on YouTube. Yeah, well, thank you, Internet Surfer. Now apparently that's the case because, you know, when I started this channel, I guess the people, the longtime listeners of the channel know I didn't think anybody would listen at all. I didn't think anybody cared. And my wife was the one who kind of talked me into doing it. And I was like, okay, well, I'll try it. And obviously I was wrong. Many people appreciate the information. Although my wife does say this following, she said, she and my neighbor said the same thing. And they said it complimentary. They said the following. You have a nice voice on the radio. It's very soothing, or on the YouTube. It's very soothing, and it's very very calming. And I'm like, well, okay, I guess that's nice. That's thank you, but if it ends up putting people to sleep, that's not a good thing. You know, the big channels have all these, you know, boisterous personalities and lively people and lively voices, and mine is very monotonous or monotone, I should say, and so. So, I mean, I guess it's good to have a nice voice. I'll tell you one voice I'm extremely jealous of is I had a channel. I showed a video with a YouTuber. He was a black man, and he was talking about, I can't remember what he's talking about. He's talking about something in his backyard, and man, I'm jealous of that guy's voice. He has the best voice. I mean, it's like, you know, very powerful voice. I wish I could remember the channel's name. It's on one of the episodes I had months ago. But that guy has a good voice. I don't know. Anyway, I'm digressing. Randy from Bulgaria says, shout out to Micah Woods, who linked your channel in his latest show. Oh, okay. Well, that's nice of him. He's getting very good feedback from his viewers about your approach in turf industry. So lots of pros are watching you now. Oh, okay. Well, that's coincidental then, because, or maybe it's not coincidental. I don't know. But that's nice of Micah to say something positive about the channel. I'm glad he's listening or watching. I know he'll be listening and watching tomorrow. So we'll see. Okay. Let's get to the episode. Where's the, there it is. Okay. Let's get to the paper. This paper is entitled Bentgrass Response to Potassium Fertilization and Potassium Release Rates from 8 Sand Root Zone Sources Used in Putting Green Construction. So like I said at the beginning, I want to make sure we're clear. This is on putting greens, high sand, very low retention of nutrients. Okay. It's nutritionally one of the worst case scenarios that you can make in turf grass science is to make a rooting zone that has virtually no capacity to retain cations or nutrients. I mean, it's very, very low, extremely low. But we need that in putting greens to resist compaction and to maintain the turf quality as it gets so much traffic, right? But we have virtually no nutrient retention. And even in these soils, and they're not soils, even in these root zones, we still find the application of potassium sometimes doesn't make any difference because there's already enough in it. Okay, I want to make sure that's clear. There's a different, that's the worst case scenario. And in your lawn or your fairway or your sport turf or your sod farm, it's probably, you're probably much better off than a sand-based putting green. And even the sand-based putting green usually doesn't need that much potassium. Okay, I want to make sure that's clear. This was published in the International Turf Society Research Journal in 2001. For those of you who are unfamiliar, the International Turf Society Journal is not a particularly well-respected journal, to be frank. It's sort of the garbage can of turf grass publications. People throw stuff in there that can't get published anywhere else, unfortunately. That's usually what happens. But it doesn't mean every article is bad. I have several articles in that journal. And when you get in the journal, you'll oftentimes, as authors, you can use that as an opportunity to go to the meeting and present the paper. And the meeting is held every 4 years. And it might be in China or United States or England, or they move it all over the world. And I'm just saying that to say that the journal is not an impact factor journal, meaning it doesn't have enough publications to warrant being included as a significant journal in the sense of in the scientific realm. So it is what it is. It doesn't mean all the journals, the articles are poor. This article is not one of those. It's a very good article. But I'm just saying that when you're reading something in this journal, you want to be a little careful. Okay. So many articles in this journal are only 1 year, or they're just a lab study or whatever. It's not a robust study. Any robust multi-year studies that are thoroughly vetted and thoroughly refereed are probably going to go in a higher journal. That's all I'm saying. So I guess I'm not sure why Destin Gallard put it in this journal, because this is a pretty good paper. I think it could have gone in a higher tier journal, but nevertheless. Okay, so bentgrass response to potassium fertilization on putting greens. Introduction. The effect of potassium fertilization on turfgrass response has varied from positive growth responses, and he has a couple of citations for positive responses, to a limited or total lack of responses. Also, turfgrass response to potassium or lack thereof has been shown to be related to nitrogen fertilization levels. Now we have, and I'll put it up before the end of the show if I remember, we have a scoreboard that we're keeping on potassium. One's positive column, one's no response column, and one's a negative response column. And what he's doing is, in the first introductory paragraph, is he's describing the scoreboard. Sometimes you see a positive response, sometimes you see none at all. Most of the time it's related to the nitrogen fertility. The absence of plants to respond to fertilizer potassium in sandy soils that are low in soil test extractable potassium by routine laboratory tests may be explained by the release of potassium from non-exchangeable forms at rates which satisfy the plant's requirement for potassium. Knowing the difference of potassium release from non-exchangeable forms among sand root zones used to construct putting greens could provide an index to K availability over an extended period of time. So what he's saying is that when we see no response to applying potassium on sand-based root zones, it may be a result of potassium-bearing minerals releasing the potassium into the soil solution. The objectives of the study were to determine the response of bentgrass grown on different high sand root zones to potassium fertilization, and to evaluate potassium release from non-exchangeable forms as an index of K availability in sand root zones. So what the authors are saying when he says non-exchangeable forms, he's meaning forms of potassium that are from potassium-bearing minerals that are not exchanged by the acid on a soil test, the soil test extractant. So when a soil test, when the extractant is added to the soil, there's usually an acid, sometimes there's a chelate, sometimes there's all sorts of different extractants, but it will remove a portion of potassium from the soil. What's in the soil solution, it will remove, as it's soluble already, but then some portion of what's on the exchange sites or on organic matter, whatever it might be, is also removed. And what they're saying is there's other forms of potassium that are not exchangeable, okay, and they want to evaluate that. Materials and methods. The soils used in this in the study are root zone mixes with high sand content used in putting green construction. The root zones used were from 8 different sources, 2 within Connecticut and 6 from outside Connecticut. So these authors were in Connecticut. Okay. Don't get lost if you're a homeowner or you're a lawn care operator and this is on putting greens. This is still valid and useful to you because it's going to talk about potassium bearing minerals being releasing potassium. It doesn't matter whether it's from a sand or native soil. It's going to happen less frequently, more than likely, in sand soils. It's going to happen more frequently in your native soils, usually. Okay. And if it's occurring, the chances of you seeing a potassium response are almost zero. Okay. Greenhouse experiment. A greenhouse experiment was conducted to determine bent grass response to potassium fertilization among sand root zone sources and to determine potassium release rates by measuring potassium uptake by bent grass in those root zones with no potassium added. 10 seeds of pencross gripping bent grass were sown into each container. That's how they planted the greenhouse experiment. Potassium was applied as KCl at planting, so potassium chloride, after thinning the plants and after the first 3 harvests for a total of 250 milligrams per kilogram of potassium of the root zone mix. Sorry. Potassium treatments were designated as K sub 0 and K sub 1, with 0 being no potassium and K sub 1 being 50 milligrams per kilogram of potassium. The root zone soils were sub-irrigated to ensure no K loss from leaching. So potassium is very mobile, particularly in sand soils. And what he's saying is they didn't irrigate the pots from top. The bottom of the pots were probably perforated, and they moved water up into the tray, probably sitting on trays. And through capillary action, the soil moved the water up into the root zone rather than the opposite, where potassium may have been leached through the root zone. In this case, potassium couldn't have been leached through the root zone because water would be moving up from the tray, up from the bottom of the pot. Oven dry weights of clippings were used to assess yield at each harvest and combined yields of 4 harvests as a result of fertilization. And okay, roots were harvested at the completion of the experiment. So we're measuring clippings, we're measuring roots. Sub-irrigation was discontinued. So this is important because he's also going to measure drought tolerance, or he's going to measure drought resistance, basically. Okay, so listen how they did it. Sub-irrigation was discontinued after the last harvest and the root zones allowed to dry. When the plants in the pots developed moisture stress to the point of permanent wilting, soil samples were collected and gravimetric moisture content of each pot determined in order to ascertain the effect of fertilizer potassium on moisture stress of the bent grass as a function of potassium fertilization. Visual observation of potassium deficiency on the foliage was noted at the first sign of the symptom occurring. So they're measuring clipping yields, they're measuring roots, and they're also measuring the influence of potassium on drought. And they also actually measured the visual observation of potassium deficiency, which way that they will explain verbally the what potassium deficiency looked like in their case on the turf grass. They also did a laboratory study. In the laboratory study, 2 laboratory methods, 1 molar nitric acid and continuous leaching of 1 normal hydrochloric acid, were employed to index potassium release from non-exchangeable forms for each root zone and to relate the potassium extracted by each method with K uptake, K content in the leaf tissue, and total yield and root growth. So what they're going to do is they're going to take the soils, and I like this stuff. It's not really pragmatic. You're not going to really, as a user, you're not really going to use this information per se, but I like the some things that we do in science when we're looking at something that's not necessarily pragmatic, but it provides better information about certain soil dynamics whenever we have a almost completely controlled system. And we want to know differences between soils in terms of potassium release or potassium absorption, or we'll do things like forming isotherms so we know how much was sorbed versus how much is removed later and so forth. There's all sorts of things we can do that are not pragmatic, but are very useful in the long run to understand the system better. And what they did in the system was they had the soil columns, and they just had a continuous leached amount of acid through the columns. So if you're familiar with HPLC columns, which maybe you're not, but it's a, think of it as a, this is not what they did, but think of it like this. Imagine a straw filled with soil. Okay. And at the top of it, you're going to create a certain amount of flow of water. And in this case, it was water with acid. And you're going to continually flow acid through that column. And at the bottom of that straw, you're going to collect out the leachate, the solution that gets leached out the bottom. Now, imagine if you have a soil that has potassium-bearing minerals in there that are not measured in a soil test, a traditional soil test, and you're leaching through a very strong acid. What may happen is, as that acid moves through the straw that has soil in it, there's going to be some of that potassium be removed. And if you just continually pump the acid through, you'll see the difference between this soil and another soil as to their capacity to release potassium. You would never do that in real life, but it gives us an idea. Hey, this soil released a lot of potassium under this setting, whereas this soil did not. And it gives us some confidence as to what you might be able to predict will occur with potassium deficiencies in one soil versus the other, because one is able to release more potassium than the other. And he shows that in here, and I like the graph they used. It's very useful, okay? Super TA, you can show up anytime you want. No worries, okay? Says he's tardy, but you're present. I appreciate you showing up, Super TA. So let me read through the rest of the materials and methods, and then I'll go back to the table. Potassium removed from those columns that I just mentioned that are kind of in a straw, think of it like a straw, and the potassium is being removed from the soil in that straw as acid is moved through there consistently, continuously. The potassium removed was determined in the continuous leaching study after 1, 3, 5, 7, and 9 liters were leached through 25 grams of soil at a rate of flow of 1 liter per 6 hours. Potassium accumulation curves were plotted for each soil. I personally have a warm place in my heart for stuff like this because I used to do this when I was in school. In fact, I have a publication on it somewhere that at some point maybe I'll show, where all I want to know is what is the difference between two soils. It doesn't necessarily have to be in a pragmatic assay, okay? It can be done in a variety of different ways in the lab. And what they chose to do is just continually pump the system through at the top and at the bottom and just collect out the bottom, a consistent, continuous flow of acid. And then between the different soils, you can determine which one has the greater capacity to release or absorb potassium or whatever the case might be. And then from our perspective as scientists, we can go out to you all and say, this soil has a tremendous ability to release potassium compared to that soil. If you have a sand, for example, you have two different sands you're choosing from to top dress your football field with, or your putting green with, or your lawn with. You can say, well, if you have two choices and we already have this information, we can say, well, this soil here is going to release a tremendous amount of potassium, and it's going to do it for a very long time in a very slow pattern because it has potassium-bearing minerals in it. That might be of interest to you if you're adding them to a soil that is already low in K. Okay. That's why that information, that sort of assay is important to appreciate. Let's look at the soils that they used. Table one is the chemical and physical properties of root zone sources. They have, I think they said, eight soils, and they denoted them or they identified them as Florida, Kansas, Maryland, Oklahoma, Redding, Rockledge, Shorehaven, and Woodway. And the pHs range from about 6.1 all the way up to 8.1. The Kansas soil is 8.1. The Shorehaven soil was 6.1. And Oklahoma was 7.8. The Redding soil, which we're going to find is quite unique, has a 7.3 pH. The CECs range from 0.8. Now remember, these are sands, range from 0.8 up to about 4.5, 4.3, something like that. Now the exchangeable K, which is what you would detect or determine on a soil test, on a valid soil test, okay, the gold standard of soil testing, this is the exchangeable K that you would determine on that, has the exchangeable K ranging from anywhere from 2 to 15 parts per million. Okay, and I think if I'm not mistaken, they used something else. I mean, look, extracted by can't remember the soil analysis or the soil extractant they used here. I'll see if I can find it before I leave. Let me see if I can find it real quick before I go any further. Oh, yeah, here it is. So the cation exchange capacity and exchangeable potassium were determined by the neutral 1 molar ammonium acetate method. So there you go. It's ammonium acetate. Okay. So the exchangeable ranged from like 2 to about 15 using the 1 molar ammonium acetate, which is fairly low. Organic matter ranged from, wow, 0.01% up to 2.1%. That one's low. Kansas is quite low. Remember, these are sands. Now, we look at the particle size distribution. We can see all of them had sand in excess of 95%. Some of them were greater than 99%. So 95% sand, 2 or 3% silt, and very, very little clay. 1.5% or less in clay. Most of them are quite low in clay. Okay, so high sand. This is for putting greens. They have a variety of different pHs, not too extreme in the ranges. The CEC ranges from 0.8 up to about 4 or 5, something like that. The organic matter is very low in some of them, but up to about 2.1% in others. So it's, you know, a mixture in high sand, okay? That's the sands that they used. That's the, you know, how they were, I don't know, the characteristics of them. Now let's get to the results. The yields and moisture stress. So we're going to talk about growth and the moisture stress component of these. I'm going to read some of this, but then I'm just going to show most of the results in these tables. Potassium fertilization significantly increased clipping yields on bent grass grown in Florida root zone sources at the last harvest and for total clipping yields. Let me just show this in this table. So this table, I'm looking at root zone source by potassium fertilization effects on clipping yields of pencross creeping bent grass at 4 harvest days. So harvest 1, harvest 2, and harvest 3, there were no differences in any of these soils, whether there was no potassium applied or there was some potassium applied. So the case of that we're comparing values laterally here. So we're going this way. We're going from left to right. So this 0.3 was not different than the 0.7. So when zero potassium was applied in the Florida soil, it was 0.3 on the harvest clipping yields in grams per pot. And when we added potassium, it was 0.7, and there was no statistical difference between that in harvest one. And there were no differences in any of the soils in harvest one. So potassium had no influence on clipping yields on any soil during the first harvest. Then they went to the second harvest, had no effect on the second harvest at all. So potassium had no effect on clipping yields in the first or second harvest. Or the third harvest, that's what this NS stands for down here. So nothing happened in the first harvest, second harvest, third harvest. And then finally in the fourth harvest, the Florida sand resulted in an increase when potassium was applied. It went from 2 grams per pot to 3 grams per pot. So it increases it by a factor of whatever that is, 0.5 or factor of half, 1.5 fold. I think that's right. But that was it. None of the grass grown in any other soils resulted in increased the clipping yield as a result of applying potassium. So out of 8 soils and 4 harvests, so that's 32 harvests, 31 of them had no effect, potassium had no effect on 31 harvesting events. It resulted in an increase in 1 of 32 harvests. So that's what I'm saying. When I'm on the scoreboard, I guess I'll mark that down as in the positive. It had an effect on 1, but that column that I show, the scoreboard that I show, is not weighted. So it'll show there's a positive response in yield, but 31 of the times it didn't. So it's probably more appropriate to say it didn't have an effect, really. I mean, in one case it did, but you guys see what I'm saying there. Let's go to the next one, the next figure. In this figure, this is the continuous leaching study. The continuous leaching, let me go back and make sure that I had that on the wrong one, sorry. So this was the table. Now, the figure, this is a continuous leaching figure. We have various liters of 0.01 molar hydrochloric acid on the x-axis going from 0 to 9 liters. And on the y-axis, we have potassium leached. So this is providing an estimation or a comparison as to the ability of the soil to release potassium under this setting. These are just the soils in columns, in leaching columns. And what I want to point out is the Redding soil, which is this top one right here, is very, very consistently and linearly releasing more and more potassium the longer and longer, the more and more leachate we send through the column. It leached from, 18, 19 milligrams per kilogram, and it went up to 35, but it's basically a straight line. So in that particular Redding soil, which had pH of 7.3 and a CEC of 3.8, an exchangeable of 8.8, and there's nothing really stands out. The chemical and physical properties, there's not a whole lot that just stands out like, yes, this is what you're going to expect to see, this because this soil has this. I don't see anything standing out on that particular soil. But when you do a potassium leaching study through the column, we see that the soil is releasing a lot of potassium, and it didn't even end. It never, didn't even cap off. It was still going up at the end of 9 liters of leachate of 0.01 molar hydrochloric acid. So that's an example of the ability of some soils to release a tremendous amount of potassium compared to others. Then we see a group of soils here that released a fair amount, sort of very in a similar fashion. Okay. These are the Kansas, the Oklahoma, and the Rockledge soil that all released potassium in the first 3 liters of hydrochloric acid, released a fair amount up to about 10, and then plateaued off. And they all sort of grouped together there. Then the Shorehaven, Woodway, and Florida soil were another group down here at the bottom. These four soils down here all sort of released potassium in a similar fashion as well. So they released most of their potassium in the first 3 liters and then plateaued off all the way up to 9 liters. So you see sort of three groups where one soil is releasing a tremendous amount of potassium, and even after 9 liters, it still was releasing more and more potassium, very likely. Never reached its maximum. Then you have three soils that released a lot more than the bottom four soils. So there was a group at the bottom, a group in the middle, and then one at the very top. Okay. So you're dealing with three different situations here where potassium is being released from all of them, but some much more than others. And yet you want to take a soil test and say, our soil test potassium is 30 and I need to apply potassium. Well, okay, well, which soil? What soil are you on? What are you top dressing with? And there's all sorts of other information, because if you want to live in a world where I don't really care, I'm just going to apply potassium anyway, well, then there's no need to soil test. If you're just going to ignore the evidence and just apply phosphorus and potassium regardless, then don't even soil test at all if you're going to do it anyway. But if you're going to soil test, then I'm assuming that you're interested in actually following the evidence, actually doing it and applying nutrients in an efficient manner. And if that's the case, what I'm saying is, and what these evidence are saying, is that we need more information than just that number on a soil test to determine if we need to apply potassium. Because even when it's deficient on a soil test, what these graphs are showing is that these soils, the Redding, the Kansas, Oklahoma, and Rockledge, are very likely releasing enough potassium anyway. Okay? But it's not showing up on a test. Let's go to the little bit of the text, so I don't miss the text. I don't want to miss anything that I highlighted here. The effect of potassium fertilization on the increase in root weights in the I haven't shown the root weights yet. Woodway, Shorehaven, and Florida root zone sources compared with no potassium treatment may be accounted for by the lower potassium supplying power from those non-exchangeable forms. Now, table 6 and figure 1. Now, if we go to table 6, you're going to see some influence on roots. Table 6, you're going to see a little bit of influence on roots as we go down. Now we're going vertically here, guys and gals. And you'll see that there's a little bit of, that ain't it. He said table. Table six, but that ain't table six. Oh, here, oh, he's wrong. Table four, that was misprint or something. Okay, so here's the root weight. We have potassium being not applied and potassium being applied. And we see that there's a difference in the Woodway soil and the Shorehaven soil and the Florida soil. And we see that the application of potassium to those soils resulted in an increase in root weight. Now remember, it's Woodway, Shorehaven, and Florida. Now if we go back up to this, what do we see down here? Woodway, Shorehaven, and Florida are in the bottom grouping of these soils. Okay, the bottom grouping that does not supply hardly any potassium through the leaching study. It wasn't releasing hardly any potassium. The application of potassium to turf grass growing in those soils resulted in an increase in root weight. But the application of potassium in the other soils that was releasing more potassium did not result in an increase in root weight. Okay? That's critical to understand, because oftentimes you'll see that, oh, well, apply potassium to increase roots and whatever. And we've shown many studies that shown that there is no effect on roots in many cases. But I've mentioned before in the past, and this is why I mentioned it, is that when we see a response, it's almost always in soils that are low in potassium. And in this case, he's differentiating even soils that are low in potassium. It's even within those soils that we don't see response to potassium, and it's the soils that are low in potassium and are not releasing potassium from any potential potassium-bearing minerals in those sands. Okay. The other soils that have virtually no cation exchange capacity, very little, they have very little exchangeable potassium. Let's look at it. Okay, let me go back up to the original chart here. Okay. The soils that have the Woodway, the Shorehaven, and the Florida soil here. Okay. These are the ones that did not show a response in turf grass rooting growth. We see the Florida had a low CEC and a pH of 7.5. The Shorehaven and Woodway soils, they had two of the highest CECs at 4.3 and 3.8. Okay. We had exchangeable potassium being sort of in the lower end on the Florida of the groupings, on the lower end of the Shorehaven, but sort of in the upper end on the Woodway. Okay, we had organic material being quite, well, the highest from the Shorehaven and one of the lowest in the Florida soil. So we have a variety of differences among these soils, the Florida, Shorehaven, and the Woodway soil. We have a variety of differences. But all of them resulted in the need to apply potassium in order to increase root rate, which is right here. The other soils didn't. You didn't need to apply potassium to those soils to increase root weight, even though the other soils were also falling in line with the same CECs, the same pHs, the same exchangeable potassium, the same organic matter. I'm going somewhere with this. What I'm saying is these are typical chemical and physical properties of root zones that we measure, sands that we, and soils that we measure, pH, CEC, exchangeable potassium, organic matter. How many times you look at a soil test and you see these things on it and you go, oh, well, my pH is 6.1, I'm fine. My CEC is 4.3, might be a little low, but it's the highest in this grouping, so I'm fine. Organic matter, 2.1% organic matter, I'm probably fine. And what this is saying is that even when those numbers were the numbers, the soil still resulted in a deficiency in potassium. And even when the numbers were the similar numbers on other soils, it didn't result in a deficiency in potassium. There's a component of these soils that does not show up on a test that influences the turf grass response to potassium, and that is very likely the inclusion of potassium-bearing minerals. Okay. Hopefully I said that in a way that is easily understood. It's kind of important. Let's get to the potassium on wilt, basically on drought. Potassium fertilization has been shown to increase the incidence of wilting. I'm sorry. Hold on. I screwed up. Potassium fertilization has been shown to decrease the incidence of wilting in pincross creeping bentgrass. And he cites Waddington and Carroll's papers. However, the results of our study showed that potassium fertilization compared with no fertilizer potassium within a root zone source did not significantly delay the onset of wilting as soil moisture content was depleted. Table 4. So what he's talking about is this over here. Table 4. He's talking about this right here. Soil moisture. Potassium was not applied here. Potassium was applied here. And you see right here, there's no significant difference between the turf grass soil moisture when the turf grass wilted. Remember, he turned off the water and then he let everything dry down, which I love those studies too. That's really, you can really start seeing stuff. You can't do that sometimes in the middle of the study because it results in killing the plant. But destructive sampling like that can sometimes really tell some good tales. And after the study was over, he let it dry down. The turf grass began to wilt and he waited until it was in the permanent wilting state. And then he started measuring the soil moisture. And when they did that, they found that the differences between applying potassium and not applying potassium didn't exist. There was no difference in the soil moisture from when you did not apply potassium to when you did apply potassium when the plant was dead. So this is not supporting the idea that applying potassium, you're going to decrease drought stress. Okay. 8 different soils, and they found no differences. And what you're doing is you're comparing laterally here. So you're going this way. Okay. Sometimes the number's numerically greater when you apply potassium. Sometimes the number's numerically less when you apply potassium. But at the end of the day, it didn't matter. The plant still died, and there was no effect on the soil moisture when you apply potassium. Okay. Let's go to. I'm getting all out of whack here with the guys on YouTube. I'm trying to keep track and keep things on screen. I'm not doing a good job at it. Okay, now what I want to do is I want to read this next sentence because the next paragraph. I know it's a lot, but he explains this in a little clearer than I probably could. Leaf tissue deficiency symptoms for potassium were noted on plants growing in the Florida root zone source at zero potassium treatment just prior to harvest 2. With leaf tissue potassium continuing to decrease over the last 2 harvests. Leaf tips turned yellow, followed by a yellowing along the margins. That's a typical explanation or description of potassium deficiencies. The leaf tips start to look yellow. And they might end up, in severe cases, looking scorched. And along the margins of the leaf, you'll start to see that turn chlorotic as well. So you got to get down on your hands and knees and really start looking at those individual leaf blades. And oftentimes it helps to actually look at specific leaves on the actual stolon itself or on the rhizome, depending on what plant you got. But you got to count the leaf and which leaf number it was. Is it a newly emerged leaf or a more mature leaf? Sometimes that is what's necessary in order to identify a nutrient deficiency. The content of leaf tissue potassium taken at this harvest was 0.8% of dry tissue weight. So 0.8%. That's what it was whenever the potassium deficiency was observed. This was below the sufficiency range of 1% suggested by Jones in 1980. Lunt in 1974 also reported a minimum tissue level of 1% of dry tissue weight on Newport, Kentucky bluegrass associated with the maximum yield. It was not until the last harvest that the bent grass tissue concentration of potassium fell below 1% in all of the other root zones except for the plants growing in the Redding and the Rockledge sources. Also noted, just prior to the last harvest, were leaf potassium deficiency symptoms occurring on plants growing in Maryland, Shorehaven, and Woodway root zone sources. No deficiency symptoms were noted on the Kansas, Oklahoma, Redding, Rockledge root zone sources. These were also the root zone sources that had the greatest potassium supplying power from non-exchangeable forms shown in Figure 1 and Table 2. I'm going to repeat that. No deficiency symptoms were noted on those 4 soils. And those 4 soils happen to be these 4 soils right up here. Okay? The Redding, the Kansas, Oklahoma, and Rockledge, the ones that were releasing potassium through the column potassium leaching study. Okay? So there was no deficiency symptom, even when no potassium was applied. Potassium fertilization significantly increased leaf tissue potassium concentration within a root zone source at all four harvests. The exception was plants growing in the Kansas root zone source at harvest one and the Redding's root zone source at harvest three and four. The continued rapid release of potassium from non-exchangeable potassium form from the Redding root zone source with no applied potassium is a reflection of the continued release of potassium shown by the accumulated release curves. And that's what I showed you with those curves. The bent grass growing on the Florida, Kansas, and Maryland root zone sources removed significantly less potassium than the other five root zone sources. The amount of potassium removed by the bent grass was greater than the available potassium on the cation exchange sites. And this is the same conundrum that Dr. Soldat and Byer found in their study. They're like, it's taken up more than it's actually available. How's this going on? You know, and then they found the same thing here in 2001. Was greater than the available potassium on the exchange sites and on all root zone sources except for the Kansas root zone. This indicates that a substantial amount of potassium uptake by bentgrass is coming from structural forms with as much as 9 times the potassium taken up by bentgrass than on the exchange sites. Okay? This is not fantasy land. And the same thing happened with the Byer paper. I think they said, I forget the number, I think it was 30 times. 30 times more potassium was taken up than was actually measured in the exchange, on the exchange sites through the soil test. So clearly potassium is coming from somewhere. Okay. K release from chemical solutions. Potassium accumulation removed by continuous leaching of the 0.01 molar hydrochloric acid for the 8 root zones were plotted to produce K release curves for each root zone sources. And then I showed you that already. I'm not going to go through that paragraph because I already talked about it. Now I'm just going to get to the summary and conclusions and we'll be done. I think I'm going to make it through. I think my voice will make it. Potassium is a highly mobile nutrient in sand putting greens because of their inherent low cation exchange capacity. Therefore, the use of routine soil tests, which measure most of the potassium on cation exchange sites, do not properly predict plant available potassium for sand putting greens containing non-exchangeable potassium sources. I'm going to read that sentence probably another 100 times throughout the remainder of this channel. Because they found it in 2001. Okay, it's in a journal that's like, whatever. Since then we've discovered that's occurred multiple other times in multiple other papers where it says the use of routine soil tests, which is what most people are all using. I'm assuming you don't have access to a soil chemistry lab that you can do some funky, you know, extractions. You're going to send your soil off to a normal soil lab. The use of routine soil tests, which measure most of the potassium on cation exchange sites, do not properly predict plant available potassium he's talking about these sand soils. And then in the Byer paper, they also said specific to that sand soil. But I want you all to contextualize this a little bit. I mean, we can't go too far beyond the results here. But think about it. They're talking about sands. Sands that have virtually no nutrient retention, very few nutrients, if any, compared to native soils. And even in those, they've concluded that the soil test is not appropriate for those sand soils because there's so much potassium coming from non-exchangeable forms. So imagine what's going to happen in a native soil, a native mollisol from Oklahoma or Kansas. Okay, it's just loaded. Oh, we have high potassium or we have low potassium. It's not accounting for other non-exchangeable forms of potassium, and those potassium forms can easily contribute to the uptake of potassium by the plant. Okay, it just... You know, my position on many things, we try to believe as many things as possible that are true and fewest things as possible that are not true. But my position on many things is a result of years and years and years and years of reading this research. Okay, it's not like I just woke up one day and I had, this is what I'm convinced is true and this is what I'm, so forth. It's because of stuff like this. And this isn't the only paper. There's many, many papers that say this. And so when someone says, what should the potassium number be on a soil test? I'm like, well, I don't really know. It's probably somewhere in the 30 to 50 parts per million, maybe like 3 range, somewhere in that general area. But unless I have more information, I can't say with much confidence what it should be for you. You could be perfectly good and perfectly fine at 20 parts per million on the right soil and the right plant. Or you could not have enough at 50 parts per million in the wrong soil and the different soil and a different plant, right? But yet somehow we've fallen into this position, even in golf, where, you know, superintendents are dealing with probably, you know, different capacity of soil testing. They see these numbers and they go, well, I have 40 parts per million, so I'm good. How do you know? This author here said that test isn't even useful on these sands. Another paper said the test isn't useful on these sands. So how do you know? Epistemology. It's fair to ask that question. How do you know that the soil test is accurate? People, and I'll say this with my past before I, you know, was educated in soil testing and all these things, before I was in grad school, before I was even in undergraduate school, when I was working in universities and on their grounds crew and mowing lawns and stuff, I just assumed that all the numbers and the interpretation were valid on the soil test. Why would they send me numbers from a university that are not valid? Of course they're valid. This is what it says to do. I'm going to do it. But since then, I've learned a lot of these recommendations on soil tests, even from universities, are not as valid and precise as the literature is. Why is that? Because a lot of the interpretations and the recommendations that are provided on these soil tests are performed and agreed upon by a committee, not by the soil test specialist, him or herself. Oftentimes the specialist is obviously, you know, providing, communicating and contributing to the committee. But a soil scientist can put this in the literature. It might be 10, 15 years before a committee, somebody actually sits in front of a committee and says, hey, we have to change these recommendations. These recommendations are no longer valid. We found a more precise, accurate recommendation than the one we're using. So you see these recommendations on soil tests, so a 4:1:2 ratio. You'll have potassium levels in the 60s, 70s, 80 parts per million, and yet it'll always say apply 1 pound a K. That's what I'm talking about. We can't continue to go. If the committees on these nutrient oversight committees and these plant soil test committees are delayed and refuse to change their recommendations, I can't control that. But what I can control is my actions based upon the evidence that's published in the literature. And from what I can tell from what's published in the literature, I can make a more accurate recommendation and interpretation on a soil test than what many of the soil reports will provide. That's not the case in all cases. You know, there's many universities that are more rapid in their changes to these recommendations. But I can pull up probably 30 soil tests right now that have soil test potassium levels greater than 60, 70 parts per million omega 3, and all of them are saying to apply 1 pound of potassium. I mean, it's crazy. So anyway, somehow I got off on a soapbox there. I apologize. So this says basically the soil test is not useful for these particular sands for potassium. That's what the summary and conclusion says, the very first two sentences. Those sands that contain non-exchangeable forms of potassium-bearing minerals can contribute potassium to plants as they weather and could be a reason for the lack of plant response to applied potassium. The lack of response to potassium fertilization found in sand putting greens reported by Colclo and Lawson, I don't know how to pronounce that name, in 89, has been attributed to potassium derived from sand. And since then, there's been the Bayer paper and other papers that have also concluded that. A large amount of potassium has been shown to be contained in the sand fraction of some loamy sand soils by Sadusky, in 1987, which becomes available to plants from mineral weathering and is a reason that some crops do not respond to potassium fertilization, even though conventional soil tests indicate low potassium availability. It's the same. He finished this paragraph same way you started the paragraph, which is wise, is that even though the soil test says you're low in potassium, we still don't see a response to the plant because the soil is probably releasing potassium in a manner in which the soil test can't account for. Our results show that potassium fertilization generally had little effect on clipping yield of bent grass grown on sand root zones, even though they tested low in exchangeable potassium. However, root weight was significantly increased by potassium fertilization on those root zone sources with a low potassium supplying capability. whereas potassium fertilization had no effect on root weight in the other root zone sources where potassium release from non-exchangeable forms was greater. In our study, potassium fertilization did not influence moisture stress tolerance as soil moisture content was depleted. So the short and skinny of it is, on the conclusions, is that it had no effect on root zone or root weight except for in one situation, and it was from a soil that had low potassium supply capability. That was it. And it had no effect on the ability to resist drought. Potassium had no effect on that at all. So in general, potassium had nothing, no effect at all on anything except in the soils that had very little capacity to supply potassium. The results of this study suggest that release of potassium from primary minerals contained in some sands used in root zone mixes is occurring at rates which satisfy bentgrass requirements for potassium. The uptake of potassium by bentgrass also revealed differences in potassium release rates from non-exchangeable forms of potassium among the sand root zones. There were differences. Different soils released it differently. The two laboratory methods presented in this study provided quicker means to assess potassium release rates from non-exchangeable potassium sources. Because of its simplicity, the one molar nitric acid extraction method may provide an alternate to routine laboratory method procedures. Okay, I don't know why I highlighted that. That's a little bit more detail than you probably need to know. Each soil released potassium at a different rate, different amounts, which is another reason why I'm not convinced by any stretch of the imagination that one soil test number is valid for multiple soils, different soils and different turf grasses. You can't have one number. In this particular study and in the buyer study, they're flat out saying the soil test itself is not useful at all for these sands to predict the potassium availability and need of the turf grass in these particular soils. It wasn't useful at all. And then you start changing up the soils, the released potassium was completely different among all these different soils. Well, they actually had three groupings. The soils release potassium in three distinctly different patterns. So what soil do you have? You know, what turf do you have? There's a lot of different things that need to be accounted for before I can provide much confidence in a single recommendation to potassium on a soil test, which, by the way, I would never do if I didn't know what the turf grass looked like. What if your turf grass is fine? I don't care what the number is on a soil test. I really don't. If your turf grass is acceptable to you and acceptable to your clientele and your coaches and your, you know, everybody's happy, soil test is relevant, okay? And in this case, they concluded it is relevant on these particular soils with potassium. It's completely irrelevant. Tomorrow, I'm going to have a show starting at 9 a.m. with a guest. You're definitely going to want to be here for that. It's a one-off thing, and I hope we have a good show tomorrow. I hope my voice holds out. But if it doesn't, I think my guest can hold his own. I know my guest tomorrow can hold his own. So if my voice goes out, I'm gonna lean on him to carry the weight. I'll see what I can do. anything in the chat before I go? Oh, thumbs up, people. Oh, only five left. Did I get five subscribers? Is that what you're saying, Ignacio? Five to go before I hit the 1,000. It'll probably happen later today, I suppose. I don't know. I'm not sure really why it's that big of a deal, but it is a milestone. You know, 1,000. 1,000 is a good number. CBO Hobo, enjoyed the show. Can someone tell me what MSON is? Hope all have a good... I don't know what MSON. I know what MLSN, or I don't know what MSON is. I'm sorry, I don't. Can't remember off the top of my head. The song today is from someone I've seen three or four times. And I think this is the studio version. The live version is like 15 minutes long, so I can't do that one. It's a little too long. So I hope you enjoyed it. But we'll be back tomorrow to talk about potassium, again, potassium. And we're going to actually show some data on potassium increasing the risk of disease again from another study. Okay. All right, guys and gals, I really appreciate everybody showing up. I hope you have a great day. I'll see you tomorrow at 9 a.m. Eastern time. See ya. Bye.